All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. That's right, we got decisions, decisions, decisions. That's what this whole week has been about, is decisions. All right, maybe that's just me, but I don't think so. Anyway, we have a packed show, and I'm going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we'll hear a recent interview with Heather Ann Thompson. She's a historian at the University of Michigan and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And we'll be talking about the nationwide prison strike, which began August 21st. You don't want to miss this, but opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show, and it's never soon enough, Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for RevCom.us Revolution newspaper and a co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. And we're going to be talking with Sansara right now about Kavanaugh and the Constitution and resistance and the need for a real revolution. This interview took place prior to nationwide actions protesting the Kavanaugh nomination, but the need for resistance that we talked about is still just as urgent. Soon, actually on September 4th, hearings are set to begin in the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. If this confirmation goes forward, it's going to mark a radical transformation in the highest court in the land, a major leap in the consolidation of Trump Pence's fascist America. And I wanted to have Sansara on to talk about all this. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you again. Let's jump right into this. A statement has been put out that everyone who refuses to accept the fascist America really should be mobilizing and participating in these protests. So I wanted to ask you, what is the importance? Let's just start off real quick with what is the importance of these protests now?
Well, I think we're facing Donald Trump's second Supreme Court nomination, and really at a very dangerous time. I think any judge that he would put on the Supreme Court is a great threat. He promised from the beginning that he would only appoint judges who would repeal Roe versus Wade, women's right to decide for themselves when and whether to have children, to not be reduced to incubators. He's promised that he would let the Supreme Court picks be vetted by the Mike Pence Christian fascist wing of his regime and the Federalist Society and all of this. So that alone, which we should get into, would be a horrendous situation, a judge like that. Then you have the fact that it would be a tipping of the balance of the Supreme Court. 5 out of the 9 justices, so-called justices, I have a hard time using that word for these people, would be really in a extreme fascist mold. And that would be a whole nother level of horror. And then it's coming in the context of really a year and a half, 2 years of fascism being imposed through the regime, coming after really decades of this growing fascist movement being built up through the state structures, the military structures, the legal structures of this country. And the Supreme Court now under Trump-Pence regime would be a major leap in the consolidation of fascism, which is what this regime is imposing in an all-around way, with its demonization and ethnic cleansing of immigrants, with its Muslim ban, with its vicious assault on women's rights, its escalation and ripping up of escalation of war threats, including nuclear war threats against the world, and ripping up of international alliances and norms. And there's just so it's an extremely dangerous thing. The court, Kavanaugh, who he is in his own right, but it's sitting in a moment that you cannot look at it just in isolation. It's sitting in a moment where the most powerful empire in the whole world, in the history of the world, the American imperialist empire, is undergoing a qualitative change to fascism. And the Supreme Court nomination and the tipping of the Supreme Court in the context of that is a major leap in locking that in place. It's a threat to all of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's actually what you were getting at when you talked about this horrendous situation some more, because I'd really like to dig into that so people understand just what is the situation that we're looking at.
Can you help me out with in which capacity are you asking? I mean, I could go anywhere. If you want me to pick, I'll pick. But if you have something in mind,
no, I was just thinking. I was just thinking when you started out, you were talking about the situation, the importance of what's happening. We started out talking about the importance of protest, but you also talked about what's actually shaping up there now. What is it that we're actually looking at in relation to the courts, in relation to the ruling class and what they're doing? You made a comment. I thought you had something you were thinking about. You made a comment. You said, this in itself is a horrendous situation. And it is. And it just seems to me that there's things that are, people, there's a way that people just kind of, people just it kind of rolls over people a lot, where you get lost in all the things that are hitting you in the press and whatnot. But there's a real situation here that's developing that is part of a fundamental change that's being fought for by Trump and all the fascists in the government. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is true. Look, every day there's a new crime against humanity. There's a new shock to the conscience of the world. There's a new scandal. There's something new breaking. And it's hard and it's dizzying to try to keep track of it all. And actually, it has a numbing effect on people. It has there's a tremendous amount of normalization of this openly white supremacist, white fascist Trump-Pence regime that's gone on for the last year and a half. But I think it is, let's just step back to basics. We live in a country where even in its sort of normal workings, even before you have Trump and Pence at the helm of it imposing a fascist America, you have millions of people locked in prison and mass incarceration. You have white supremacy woven into the DNA and the functioning of this system from its founding in slavery down to today. You have abortion rights hanging by a thread under Obama. It was 6 states with only 1 abortion clinic, doctors being assassinated, women being harassed on their way in and out of the clinics, having a hard time accessing birth control. You have torture. You have an island outside the rule of law called Guantanamo that's just indefinite detention torture that goes on and on. This is the normal workings of U.S. capitalism and imperialism. And it's a system that it's an unjust system. It's an oppressive system, an exploitative system, and it cannot be reformed and it needs to be overthrown. But instead of that, you have a Trump-Pence come to the top of it, and they are undergoing a qualitative change. They're taking everything that's been in the roots and the foundation of this country to greater extremes. They're bringing back unbridled, open white supremacy with the Nazis marching in the streets and the state tearing immigrant children from their parents and locking them in cages and terrorizing whole populations, to the promise to appoint a judge that will completely criminalize abortion and birth control in this country, to the Supreme Court even before this new appointment, and giving backing to open bigotry against LGBTQ people and the master bakery cake ruling that happened, where the baker was allowed to deny the sale of a cake to a gay couple for their wedding. So this has been the situation, but then this system has produced, and this is something, it has produced a fascist regime and installed it in the highest offices of power in every branch of government they control. And now they're moving to really radically remake the Supreme Court in a way that rips up what even nominally existing traditional democratic rights were promised, if not always delivered, to the people in this country. And so you have, Kavanaugh, who has his fingerprints involved in George Bush's torture program. Kavanaugh is somebody who was involved in the impeachment of Bill Clinton, which was really a right-wing witch hunt, if ever the word applies, against Bill Clinton. It was part of the growing of a fascist movement. Kavanaugh was involved in the legal case taken to the Supreme Court when the presidency was given to George W. Bush against, to stop the election recount. Kavanaugh was involved in every major battle in the last couple of decades that has been a pivotal nodal point in the escalation of fascism in this country, down to today when you have a Trump-Pence regime in power, moving like a juggernaut, imposing a Muslim ban, doing all of this ethnic cleansing against immigrants, calling whole countries S-hole countries, using the language of Nazis against immigrants, calling them animals. I mean, all of this going on, and then putting another member on the Supreme Court to give all this legal sanction from the highest offices. And Kavanaugh, who has said, no, the president is really has an even wider view of executive power, even less willing to hold the executive branch to the rule of law by any check or balance on that. It's a very dangerous tipping point, the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, and it has very radical implications beyond what most people understand. It's not, this is not a pendulum swing we're experiencing. Fascism is a qualitative change in the form of government. It's still imperialism, it's still capitalism, but it's a form of rule that is more extreme in the harm that it causes to millions of people who are targeted by it. And it is one in which it closes down the channels, both within the ruling structures and from the people, to pose any kind of dissent or protest or contest the direction. It closes that down. And this is why it is very important that people come out in the streets to protest this nomination, stand up and put themselves on the line to stop this nomination, but do so in a way that is connected to two things. First of all, connected to the fight to actually build up the strength, as RefuseFascism.org has called for and has been organizing for, to bring forward the millions who do not like this direction to go into the streets and stay in the streets and drive the regime from power, to stop this nomination in a way that's building the strength to do that. And two, more fundamentally, for those who recognize that that what we see going on with Trump and Pence is actually got its roots in the Confederacy, got its roots in the history of this country's patriarchy and Christian fundamentalism and America First, manifest destiny from the theft of land in Mexico to the conquering around the world, that this is actually fundamental to the nature of the American system. We need to fight this in a way that's building up the strength to make a revolution, to get rid of this whole system. Because this is, I mean, a world where you can have a fascist regime, a society and a system that would put people like this in charge of the lives of millions and millions of people in this country and billions around the world is a system that has to be, its time is up. It's long past served any positive role in the history of humanity. And we can do better and we need to do better. And that's, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention there is a constitution written by Bob Avakian for a whole different way that the world, that this society could be structured economically, politically, socially, a constitution for a new socialist republic in North America for day one after an actual revolution. A different kind of society is possible. So we need to be putting that on the table and fighting for that as we join with others to go out in the streets and protest this nomination.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that comes up too, and I know that you were speaking about this, and I just was thinking about it as you were, this point that comes out so often of that people wondering what the hell they should be doing and thinking about this and what can they do to stand up around this. And, you know, so much effort is being zeroed in on trying to, like, convince people that they should go and they should make friends with the people in the Congress and try to figure out ways to deal with this in a way that would, like, sort of smooth over differences and sort of then maybe progress. And I think in relation that there's that, and then there's the other thing that I wanted to, which would be sort of wrapping this up, but I think it's really important too, because you also, you know, I've heard you talk about this before as well, and this is something that's been coming out in Revolution and on the website. This whole idea, there's another booklet, another pamphlet that's out that actually is extremely important for people today, and it's related to what I was just talking about, how people are looking at how the struggle over how to proceed in terms of standing up against this. There's also something that's been out called How We Can Win, How We Can Really Make a Revolution. Because, you know, I think it's really important when people talk about let's make a revolution, that is a big question there that actually is spoken of, and it's extremely important in terms of what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, well, I think to speak briefly to both of what you're raising, the institutions of this country, the institutions of power, the institutions for decision-making, the institutions of politicians, they are not our institutions, and we cannot use them to exercise our will. The Democratic Party is a ruling class party. They have different interests than the Republicans. Well, not different interests. They have different approach. They have a different idea on how to exercise the rule of American imperialism, but they have the same fundamental interest in securing, expanding the imperialist and American imperialist empire. That's what they're fighting over, not whether to do that, but how to do that. They are not an instrument. The Congress, the Democratic Party, the elections, those are not instruments of the people. Those are instruments of the rule over the people. And we, to get rid of this system, there is a strategy. How We Can Win, How We Can Really Make Revolution is available at revcom.us. And it's not revolution off in the future. You hope for it and wish for it. It's revolution. You're working for it now. You're fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. You're joining and raising your head and creating conditions through struggle from below where they cannot go forward with the consolidation of fascism. But you're doing it while propagating and spreading to others the fact that the world does not have to be this way. calling on people, like I'm calling on listeners, to get into the work and the leadership of Bob Avakian, to get into the strategy for revolution in How We Can Win, to read the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America, to go to revcom.us every day and find out the truth about where all these nightmares come from. Why is the system doing this? Why, after so many generations of people struggling and sacrificing and winning reforms, are we still in a situation where the greatest things people achieved are the things that are most viciously being aimed at and taken down by this system and its current rulers? This is, and to join with the revolution clubs, the system that rules over us is very powerful, but it also has vulnerabilities. And this is what's detailed in that statement on strategy, how we can win, how we can really make revolution, is how we can come together today to fight against these crimes that are being carried out and the consolidation of fascism and the nightmare they mean for our people here and all over the world, in a way that's building up the strength and the unity and the organization and the understanding so that we can make an actual revolution and overthrow this system at the soonest possible time and bring about a new society that is fit for human beings, where people have, just to give a couple examples, I know we're out of time, but things that this system could never grant: the right to eat, the right for people to encounter each other, not as part of antagonistic classes that are scrambling for survival and competing for survival, the right to live in a world where the environment is cared for and where we're trying to repair the damage, as opposed to living under a system where it's considered an externality to profit. To do those things, first of all, those things are possible. A world where women are not battered and raped and, you know, 1 in 3 on the planet, 1 billion women. This is possible, but it's only possible with an actual revolution. And we need to be fighting for that. We need to be preparing for that. We need to be studying that, propagating the leadership, Bob Avakian and the Revolutionary Communist Party, or engaging the work that they've done if you're not convinced, as we join together and fight against the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh in the streets, which is where it matters, and uniting with others to build up the strength to drive this regime from power all of humanity.
All right, Censora, thank you very much for joining us today. Always a pleasure.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Censora Taylor, writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper and co-initiator of RefuseFascism.org. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
This track is not an attack upon the American people. It's an attack upon the system within which they live. Since 1945, the United States has attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments. In the process, the U.S. This track is not an attack upon the American people. It's an attack upon the system within which they live. Since 1945, the United States has attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments. In the process, the U.S. has caused the end of life for several million people and condemned many millions.
That was Low Key with Obama Nation. Prisoners across the country have launched a nationwide strike to demand improved living conditions, greater access to resources, and the end of modern-day slavery. Prisoners in at least 17 states are expected to participate in the coordinated sit-ins, hunger strikes, work stoppages, and commissary boycotts from August 21st until September 9th, the 47th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising. Joining us to talk about this nationwide prisoner strike is Heather Ann Thompson, author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to talk to you again. Let's start by talking about the significance of the prisoner strike. It's a national strike. It's demands. But what's the significance of this?
Well, I think it's most significant that this is becoming a regular occurrence now. In 2016, there was anywhere from 20 to 40,000 folks that went out then. Of course, we don't know for sure because these prisons are so blocked to the public. But here we are in 2018, and I think a lot of the hope for bipartisan criminal justice reform has evaporated, and folks on the inside are still suffering, and so they're standing up one more time. I think it's significant in its frequency and in the kind of desperation of the calls from the inside.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a lot of comparisons between what's going on now and with the Attica Rebellion in 1971, and the prisoners themselves have pointed this out, including even just the fact
I think it's incredibly important to remember that we have been at this task of making prison conditions more humane for literally nearly 5 decades since Attica. And because it's mostly lip service, because we have not yet really done much to improve conditions on the inside, And in fact, arguably, they've gotten worse and worse as the recent riot at the facility in South Carolina showed. Looking back to Attica reminds us of the power of folks standing together and bringing the world's attention to what it's like to really be behind bars.
Mm-hmm. Now, they've also called for boycotts of agencies and companies that benefit from prisoner labor. They've actually turned around in a certain sense in this instance, in this event, that they've turned around and actually put it out to people outside of prison that there's actually a role that people need to play in relation to all these other forces that are basically, in one way or another, engendering all this.
Right. I mean, I think one of the, to me, one of the most powerful things of the message in this particular strike is that exact point that folks on the outside have a real responsibility to get involved and can get involved, both by simply calling attention to this, but also by boycotting goods if you know that they're being made in such an exploitative fashion. In other words, prisoners aren't getting paid any money to make them, and nor are workers on the outside. The only folks making money are the actual state institutions or the private companies using the labor. And to the extent that we know who those companies are, that's certainly a role people can play. But also just simply calling attention to the fact that these are overwhelmingly public institutions that we pay for, that we ostensibly support as making our society safer, and yet we don't have a clue what goes on inside. And what folks tell us is going on is pretty horrific overcrowding, terrible nutrition, lack of basic medical care, privatized sources in the prison so that the folks inside literally cannot afford to talk to their children, and we're at a real crisis point, so folks on the outside can shine the light on that.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that gets me too is, and I want to return to this a little bit, because it was really significant to me that when you actually look at the dates that we talked about of the strike is stretching over and its relationship to significant events in relation to prisoners and actually from George Jackson and the murder of George Jackson, and then to the Attica rebellion, which, your book really did a tremendous job in opening up to people the reality behind the Attica rebellion and what was happening to people beforehand. And I thought this idea where the prisoners themselves are really calling attention to this in terms of the idea that there's the beginning and the end of it is nailed to significant events in prisoners resisting what's happening to them, what's being done to them.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, despite the fact that so many prisons have banned my book from the inside, there have been a lot of folks who've managed to get it and read it, and there's been already, long before the book, a sort of deep collective knowledge of the importance of Attica in terms of, nearly 1,300 men standing together across racial lines and political divisions to demand basic human rights. And that, folks know about that. It's important. It's an important marker. And I think this was an additionally important move to begin the prison strike on the anniversary of the death of George Jackson, because that was a surprise, I think, to some. Why would you begin a rebellion on a day that commemorates the death of someone as important to prisoner rights activism as George Jackson? But notably, that's what motivated the Attica brothers so many years ago. I mean, it was when they heard that George Jackson had been gunned down in San Quentin that they went to the mess hall that morning in utter silence. And this is a few weeks before the actual uprising. But, it signaled that, look, things have gotten so bad that now when you're sentenced to prison, you might end up dead inside. And that's what happened to Jackson. And notably, that's what happened in South Carolina in April that really touched this strike off. Seven individuals inside of the Lee Correctional Facility were stabbed to death inside. In this case, this was an internal struggle between prisoners. But the reasons it happened were the same: terrible conditions, lack of oversight on the inside, lack of supervision. And so calling for this to begin on the anniversary of George Jackson's death is deeply significant, because it calls attention to prisons as places where you don't just serve time, but you might well end up killed. And it really underscores the crisis that we're in.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that always got me, too, with this, and particularly after, just reading about this and studying up on this, and then also reading your book, which, you know, I think is invaluable. And it's actually, it's not surprising to me that the system has tried to ban it in numerous places, you know. But one of the things is that what happened in Attica is, you know, that where the prisoners were actually saying, look, we are human beings and we demand to be treated as such. We're not going to, you know, it was really an assertion of people's humanity in the face of the most inhumane, you know, circumstances you can imagine, you know, and the actual, you know, the attempt by the system, what they do is to rob your humanity from you, you know. And today, this demand, it's interesting to me that the way this follows through, and today this demand even comes out to, in a certain way, getting expressed by, and one of the demands being an immediate end to prison slavery. And it really does sort of put these two things together and gives people a sense of the, basically, the theft of humanity from all these prisoners, and even deeper than that, the return to a certain form of slavery for a lot of the prisoners.
Well, I think that the use of the term prison slavery is so powerful because it really does just completely call attention to the fact that those folks inside have so little power to determine their own destiny. And when someone wants to profit off of their labor, because of our own constitution, that is perfectly legal. And so, therefore, even at Attica in 1971, one of the key demands was to get paid a minimum wage for basic labor done. And here we are, again, nearly 50 years later, and that still is a rallying cry. But notably, in this prison strike, just like at Attica, it's not the only cry. We put a lot of attention on the prison slavery issue, but that's a little complicated of an issue because, of course, many prisoners want to work. And it's important to note that the issue here is not labor per se. It's not working. The issue is the slavery part. It's the exploitation part. And, you know, it's also, we need to recognize that it's not just that. It's also this desire to have better conditions, better medical care. And in the case of this strike, they're actually calling for changes to the laws that have created such prison overcrowding in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this a little bit more in relation to even the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and why that's even an issue in relation to prison today. You know, and if you're convicted, that is what the one exception that they talk about is if you're convicted, actually, there's one exception to what can happen to you, and that's slavery. They're allowed to actually institute this actual slavery.
Yeah, and there's complicated reasons as to how that had ever ended up in the U.S. Constitution. But one thing that, here's the shorthand thing that folks need to understand is that this was extremely instrumental after the Civil War in effectively re-enslaving so many folks that had been newly emancipated. And it is the mechanism by which much of the South was rebuilt on this now incarcerated labor force, not an officially slave labor force, but through criminal justice laws, able to re-enslave an entire population of newly freed people. One way to think about this is that on the eve of the Civil War, you know, most penitentiaries were mostly white. And 20 years after the Civil War, penitentiaries in the South were overwhelmingly black. And that's not because white folks stopped committing crimes and, you know, black folks lost their mind with freedom. It's because the laws changed in such a way to particularly criminalize brown folks and black folks and then put them to labor in a convict leasing situation. And, you know, this is pretty much what happens after the 1960s. After that kind of freedom moment, you have laws changing and you know, within a decade, skyrocketing rates of overwhelmingly black and brown incarceration that is then subsequently put to work. And by the way, disenfranchised, which is what happened the first time, too. So it's important that we call attention to the 13th Amendment because it has a deep history that's very unsavory.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. And Heather is the author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And we're talking with Heather about the current prisoner strike that's sweeping across the country and is expected to run from August 21st until September 9th. Well, one of the things I was just thinking about as I was both going back over your book, but also following what's been happening over the last week. And one of the things that there was a number of people talking about in terms of prisoner labor, that it was Doug Blackman wrote the book, Slavery by Another Name. And as I was reading, mm-hmm. as I was reading the reports on what's going on now today with this prison strike, basically with all these people standing up and saying, no, we're not going to lay down and die. We're demanding our humanity. But there's still this thing of slavery by another name that seems to be very, very powerful in this.
Yeah, well, that's it. And it's the by another name that I think the strike calls attention to. You know, we may be officially free citizens, but when we are incarcerated, what is expected of us is no different than if we were enslaved. We have to go to work. We cannot call in sick. We have to accept whatever the wage may be, even if that wage is absolutely nothing. And the sheer extraction of labor and the extraction of profit is no different than, you know, at any other moment in history where that was utilized.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things it really seems that there's a link to what's happening between what's happening with mass incarceration in society overall in terms of the severity of the all-out assault on prisoners now in terms of rights or lack of them, and what I think is a growing genocidal assault on Black and brown people throughout society in general.
Yeah, and I don't think it's accidental that the reason why this issue is so fundamentally in our face again is not because politicians woke up one day and said, oh, my God, this is a problem, let's start talking about it. It's because it has reached such crisis proportions on the ground. That would be the policing of citizens in their community that then translates into the prosecution, that then translates into mass incarceration. That has become so acute with so many people on the inside experiencing these terrible conditions and so many people being disproportionately policed on the outside and treated badly, that there have been eruptions. And it hasn't just been in prison. It's been in places like Ferguson and Baltimore and Chicago. And, this kind of pressure from below is resonant of the 60s in the same way that this issue of wage slavery is reminiscent of the Civil War. This is reminiscent of the activism of the 60s when politicians had to respond, not because it was timely on their part, but because people were erupting on a regular basis from below.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just the laws, but there's this unquestioned sanctity of the criminal code, you know, and that today and what that's wrought. I mean, it's rehabilitation certainly doesn't seem to be the goal.
But it is interesting because, I mean, as someone who has been around the country a great deal in the last 2 years talking about prison conditions and talking even more specifically at times about Attica, I am really struck actually by the feeling that sanctity of law or the feeling that everyone is in prison because they deserve to be there or that if you do the crime, you do the time, that kind of trope, I think it's falling away a little bit. And certainly it never really had legitimacy amongst the most policed and most imprisoned folks. But even among those who've managed to escape that because of their skin color or their economic standing, are having a harder time actually believing that this stuff is about justice or that laws, in fact, are colorblind. And that's just because, you know, it begins to fall apart the minute we shine any light on it. And that's exactly what strikes like this do. I think it's important to realize that when 2016 happened and there were folks inside striking, it was very difficult to get media attention on that. You know, the media was putting its hopes, I think, a great deal on politicians to solve this. But now, in 2018, the Washington Post, Newsweek, I mean, very mainstream publications are taking this issue seriously. And that shows me that this idea of the justice system is just is really wearing thin in many quarters now.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the things that got me too is that, you know, look, when you think about this, some of the prisoner demands that I've read about, and it is really very moving to see that how deeply impacted these prisoners are around the question of the enslavement and slavery. And it's some of these prisoner demands too, though, they're the same today as they were at Attica in 1971. You know, there's a continued...
Well, that's because we got it wrong. You know, that's because, well, there's two reasons for that. One of them is because that is exactly what the system does. I mean, they're really... One of the kind of tragedies here is that there's no such thing as a humane prison, at least not in the American configuration. I mean, we're not even close to what other places like, you know, Norway or Sweden or even Germany are imagining. Our prisons are by definition deeply inhumane because we cage human beings for decades on end and isolate them. And of course, it's going to resonate on the inside as deeply resonant of slavery and deeply inhumane. And we can't get away anymore with thinking that these institutions are doing anything other than churning out more misery. And that's what these guys are calling our attention to. That's what these demands call our attention to. Again, these very basic rights. Why we got it wrong? Because we got Attica wrong. The state of New York lied about what happened at Attica. They didn't say to the public, the police came in there and killed all the protesters and killed hostages too. They said the prisoners had done that. They sold us a false bill of goods that folks on the inside are animals, that they are brutes, that they are beyond redemption. And that narrative has been just, you know, just absolutely absorbed into our culture. And I think this is what we have to change. This is where we went wrong.
Now, one of the things that you've referred to already is this South Carolina prison riot and at the Lee Correctional Institution, which, as you mentioned, 7 prisoners were killed, more severely injured. And the prison blames it on gang rivalries. But you have a different take on this. And I think it's important to explore it a little bit more because it's related to the overall assessment of what's happening in prisons overall.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's remember that any time a prison makes the news because prisoners have, quote unquote, rioted, we should always immediately stop and doubt literally any interpretation that is coming to us from the Department of Corrections, no matter what the state. And I don't say that as a conspiracy theorist. I say it as a historian and a scholar and someone who has spent a great deal of time in these institutions. Departments of Corrections always, then, now, and in perpetuity, explain chaos in a prison as the product of troublemakers and militants or gang members. And always there is a more complicated story. So when I heard news that the Lee Correctional Facility had exploded and that all of these prisoners had died, I immediately tried to reach inside to talk to some of the folks. And, you know, of course, that story was not what the state officials were telling us. It was not just about gang fights. It was about the state having completely neglected this institution, having far too few and too few trained guards inside. It was chaos. The administration put rival groups of people in the same tier, in a tier that was so shabbily constructed that the doors didn't even lock, and then pretty much just left everybody alone. And in that chaos, people were hurt. But what we never heard was that in that chaos, other prisoners were trying desperately to help, were trying to call for medical care, and that they left that institution for hours and hours and hours, nearly 7 hours, and didn't do anything. And I've seen the film from inside. These guys were filming some of the the terrible things going on inside in terms of the victims. And, you know, at any point someone could have come in to help, but they didn't. And so, again, we should just... Lee was a cry for help. These are always cries for help, and the Department of Corrections always portrays them as if it's the worst of the worst in there, committing violence for no reason.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you look at what's actually what the truth is. And when you look at the South Carolina newspaper, the state, that they talk about the number of prisoners killed in the state prisons in South Carolina more than doubled in 2017 from 2016 and quadrupled from 2 years ago. This is a pretty heavy indictment.
Well, and this is why the call for this strike on the anniversary of George Jackson's death is so meaningful, because it really does underscore this point that to be locked up and to serve time now means risking death. These prisons are so severely overcrowded. In some prisons, there is like an absolute sense that guards put
rival groups of prisoners together simply for sport, to take bets on in a gladiator-type situation on the violence. I mean, this is a sick system. And these are people's, you know, mothers, fathers, brothers, sons, uncles, who are subjected to this. And so this has nothing to do with rehabilitation. There's no possibility for making folks happier, healthier, or society safer or better. This is about warehousing, and it's about warehousing very specific groups of people, people with the least power in society on the outside, to avoid the policing that has led them to incarceration in the first place.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Heather Ann Thompson. And Heather is the author of the book Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. And we're talking with Heather about the current prisoner strike that's sweeping across the country and is expected to run from August 21st until September 9th. Let's talk about the prisoner demands. I'd like to know if you have any, you know, in particular, if you have any insight on these demands. And you know, they're very powerful, actually, because they're very simple in a certain sense. And you're looking at them and you're thinking, mm-hmm. okay, they're simple, straightforward demands. But it's also people's lives are literally bound up with whether or not these demands are actually met.
Yeah, I think that what was so powerful to me about the demands was that they were a mix of the intimate and the structural. The intimate demands for these basic human rights that, you know, one would imagine that existed in prison if you didn't know better. And the structural, the understanding that some of these problems cannot be fixed simply by making sure there's decent medical care inside or you know, making sure that we end wage exploitation and have slave labor go away. Some of these are built into our very political structure, like these terribly long sentences and the racialized policing. In other words, that it's not everyone that gets policed for breaking the law. It's only some people. And those demands really touched on both the structural and the intimate in a way that was, you know, really shows that folks on the outside need to appreciate how deeply folks on the inside get what's happening and get what the solution would be, and that any criminal justice reform that we can hope for or any changes we can hope for have to place incarcerated people at the center of those discussions of what needs to change, because they know. They know better than anyone on the outside what needs to change and how to change it.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that really got me, too, in relation to all this is that there were some places that where I read that more than, you know, for instance, the response of other people like immigrants who were in prison, more than 200 immigrants currently detained at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington, actually joined the strike. And Palestinian mm-hmm. prisoners who are imprisoned in Palestine gave a statement of support, sent a statement of support. This actually speaks to a certain universality and a hatred yeah. for what's being done here.
Yes. And then also prisoners in Canada. I feel like the United States is such an international outlier on the one hand because its prison population is so bloated compared to any other country, and its racial disproportionality is so startling, so staggering. But on the other hand, there is a recognition among other groups of people across the world that have been excessively policed and excessively marginalized and locked up in excessively brutal institutions that what is happening to Americans on the inside is what is happening to them. And there is a great deal of solidarity that is quite, quite moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things actually that got me too is that, you know, there was a quote from a prisoner who said, "The U.S. is a prison nation. Prisoners understand that they are being treated as animals. Prisons in America are a war zone. Every day, prisoners are harmed due to conditions of confinement. For some of us, it's as if we are already dead. So what do we have to lose?" And that was a very, very powerful thing, I thought.
Yes, and that kind of gets at the heart of what I was mentioning before, that for folks on the outside who've never been inside of an institution or have a very little personal connection with one, there is this feeling that something good might happen there or could happen there, or that even if nothing good can come out of it, at least people are being, you know, punished within the limits of the law. What they don't understand is that we have, for example, so many children in this country serving life sentences. We have people serving amount of solitary confinement that is beyond anything that any medical professional in any moment in history would deem humane. And all of this goes on with very, very little transparency. So when you hear from someone on the inside saying, we feel like we are almost dead, so we have nothing to lose, well, what does that mean? Well, what that means is these are people who have been in 6x8 cells, sometimes for decades, with very little human touch, very little human interaction, people who've been incarcerated so far away from their families that they've lost touch with the very people who might yet tether them back to society. And so that is not hyperbole. What you heard that person say is not hyperbole. It is the reality. These are places where people go to die, either literally or figuratively.
Mm. You know, and one of the things that in terms of what we've already mentioned somewhat, but these prisoner demands, you know, when you think about this, there's, you know, it's like they're dealing with everything that's coming down on them and fighting for both for their life, but also for a certain amount of, you know, human dignity and the recognition of your humanity. And the demands, actually, I thought that it was interesting because even in there, the demands go from the soaring to actually some things that you would look at and say, well, wow, these are pretty mundane.
Yeah, but pretty basic.
Yeah, but they actually mean everything to the people that are making those demands. And that's really, it says something about what you were just talking about, the conditions that people are faced with in prison, the life that they have to live in prison.
And that's why even the issue of labor is so complicated, because, you know, sometimes people very much welcome this labor, even if it is so exploitative and terrible, because it actually will get them outside of the cell for a very short period of time where otherwise they would never get out, or, you know, might put them in a situation where they can have some fresh air finally. And when you realize that that's the level of basic human need we're talking about, then it really does give us some insight into why this is so important. And every show I've been on, every group I've ever talked to, there's always someone that feels quite unsympathetic because they'll say, look, you know, this is not a country club. You know, people have committed crimes. That's why they're in there. This is why the issue of humanity is important, because notably, none of those demands are saying free everybody. None of those demands are saying nobody should take responsibility if they committed a harm. What those demands say is, while we are doing what you have told us we must do, which is serve time in these institutions, please do not treat us as less than human while we do it. And that's powerful.
Yeah, that's very important. And you know, one of the things that I kept thinking about, and we're talking about the very serious, as you mentioned, the very serious consequences people get for asserting their humanity and for standing up, you know, and doing that. And, you know, I kept thinking about, just thinking of your book on Attica, and, you know, and it really, I thought it was really important for people to actually look at this book, and I would really recommend anybody who hasn't read it to actually go out and get it, because it actually has a lot to do with what we're talking about now. You know, and the things that things are, you know, really things are worse today than the time of Attica. And there's an importance of Attica being put out by the prisoners themselves in relation to this uprising. It's really important in terms of people seeing what's the through line here. And why do the prisoners feel so strongly about that?
Well, Attica has two legacies. And, you know, it's important to realize the power of both of them. One of the legacies is the one that you just mentioned, which is that, you know, no matter how repressive an institution wants to be, no matter how much it shuts down the doors, no matter how many years it gives for sentences, no matter how many days and hours and weeks and decades you can give someone solitary, at the end of the day, human beings will ultimately stand together to be treated as human. And that is one of Attica's most profound legacies, which is why it is always hearkened back to in moments like this. The other legacy, though, of Attica is very, very disturbing, which is that when people do that, when people do stand up and demand to be treated as human, the repression can be stunning, staggering. It is only in the reading of what happened at Attica that you understand the risks that these people take when they do stand up for basic human rights. And that's why, you know, for this particular strike, people have asked, well, how many prisoners have actually gone out, for example, on strike this week? And I always say, well, first of all, we don't know yet. It takes time because these institutions are so closed. But secondarily, it doesn't matter if two go out or 50,000 go out, because the ability to go out is itself such an enormous risk, right? The repression is so severe to stand up that people are terrified. And so just because some institutions may not have a sit-in or a strike, it's not because they don't believe in the demands or believe that they're important. It's because they live in terror of the consequences of speaking out. And to that point, those who have spoken out, we need to keep our eyes out, because the legacy of Attica shows us that the most dangerous time for prisoners, men, women, children, anyone on the inside who stands up, the most dangerous time is when it's over. Mm-hmm. It's when the media goes home. It's when no one's talking about it anymore. And at Attica, that led to, you know, months of just horrific, horrific torture that state officials then denied had even happened for the next 45 years. And so we got to pay attention, you know, next week as much as we're paying attention this week.
Right. And I have one last question for you, Heather. You're one of the voices that are standing with the prisoners today. You've been standing with them for quite some time. What do you say to people in general in society in terms of what is happening and why people need to understand the truth of prisons in America?
The reason why we all need to care about this, whether or not we know anyone on the inside or have any intimate connection to it, is because these institutions are ones that we pay for, support, at least theoretically, and they are done, whatever happens in them is done in our name. And therefore, we have a responsibility to know what that is. And we also have to understand that everybody on the inside is there, perhaps for something they did, but as likely for something that they were caught for, that we might have done, someone we might have known has done, and totally escaped censure for. And so therefore, it's not true that everyone in there is there because they should be. It's not true that everybody is in there and we're not because we shouldn't be. These are not questions of morality and injustice. The bottom line, why people on the outside should care, is that who is inside is us. They are our children. They are our parents. They are our neighbors. They are fellow Americans, or they are new Americans, even perhaps people who have just arrived on our shores, but they are all us. And how we treat people in our prisons is a reflection on how our society functions. So we want our prisons to be humane and just. And the only way that's going to happen is if we shine a light on them. And the only way we're going to shine a light on them is when we're forced to. And these kinds of moments give us a wake-up call to pay attention to what's going on inside and to understand that, you know, if it's our children in there or someone else's children in there, the standards should be the same. What must go on must be humane, and it must be truly just, not just a shimmer of justice.
Mm-hmm. All right, Heather, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and keeping some attention on this issue.
It was really good.
I the time, Michael.
Really enjoyed it. All right, and talk to you again soon,
okay,
I hope.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye. That was Heather Ann Thompson, a historian at the University of Michigan and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. We were talking about the nationwide prison strike, which began August 21st and continues until September 9th. We've got a few minutes left, so I want to play something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's called Free Yourself from the GTF, the Great Tautological Fallacy. And when you hear it, you'll see why I think it's so important. This is from the talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And you can find that on revcom.us or on refusefascism.org.
In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism. The disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF, the great tautological fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the great tautological fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world, and therefore whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Free Yourself from the GTF. You can access the entire talk at revcom.us, as well as hours of questions and answers. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Numbered Days from Ross Michael. Talk to you again next week.